From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People who have lived in the state for any amount of time have their own hunches about the way global warming has affected the place. Most of us can remember years trudging through piles of snow for days, months at a time, and lately things have seemed different. Impressions are hard to nail down and measure, but there is some science that seems to confirm the hunches. Recent studies are showing the Utah climate is in fact changing. There's less snow, more rain, fewer storms. And in a place that relies on snow and water, the implications for this kind of change are obvious. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of snow in Utah. We'll look at the studies, what they seem to be telling us. We'll explore the consequences and ask what leaders are doing to account for the coming changes. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the weekend, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Judy Fays published a piece that confirmed what a lot of Utahns had guessed at for years, that the state's climate is changing. Recent studies are showing there is less snow in Utah, more rain, fewer storms. And in a place that relies on snowpack and water, the implications for this kind of change are pretty obvious. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of snow in Utah. We're looking at the studies, what they seem to be telling us. We're exploring the consequences as well. Also, later on the program, we'll ask what leaders are doing to account for all of these coming changes. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter as well. Judy Fays is here, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, where she covers environmental issues and pollution. We should mention you can find a link to a recent article about climate change and Utah snowpack on our website. And Judy, welcome. Thanks for being with us. Rob Gillis is with us. He's the director of the Utah Climate Center at Utah State University. He's also Utah State climatologist. And Rob Gillis, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, Judy, I want to start with you. I wanted to begin, if we could, with the image that you sort of start your piece with from Bruce Tremper. He's a forecaster for the Utah Avalanche Center. And he talks about seeing these bare patches in the mountains where he used to see, I guess, you know, feet, a lot of snow anyway. Mm-hmm. We'll get to the actual science here, of course, in a moment. But I guess these anecdotal impressions are pretty compelling. I mean, a lot of us who've been here for any amount of time are sensing something's wrong. People are noticing certain things, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I started the article with Bruce's observations in his final avalanche forecast of the season, or one of his final forecasts at the beginning of April. He just commented that he was surprised to see so little snow up even in the very high elevation areas at like 9,000 feet, 10,000 feet. And he made the comment that Utah was on track to have, or at least that part of Utah was on track to have, the lowest snowfall ever on record this year.
Yeah.
That may have changed with the storms that we've had for the last couple of days. My guess is it has. But the point was that he is just one person looking at one place at one point in time. And I don't think ordinary weather information can really give us the perspective that climate science can in terms of looking at long periods of time and comparing the different variables, what the trends appear to be.
Yeah.
For Bruce, it may have been a one-time or maybe all-season experience of seeing low snow. But for the scientists, they're able to look back thousands of years and talk about what those changes have been based on all different kinds of data from all different kinds of data sources that they have.
Which makes it, of course, scientifically meaningful. But I am also interested, though, in – because I hear it all the time, to be honest with you – people's anecdotes and impressions about, gosh, it used to be so much more – you know, and everyone has an impression. You can't measure it scientifically, but it seems like people are noticing, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of other things that are happening in our weather system outside of Utah and inside of Utah that make people look at sort of the whole of the evidence from a lot of different sources and say, boy, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there's something really happening here. Again, not any one of us could probably really pull all that together and say, oh, yeah, this is really a trend. This has to be climate change. I think the science really brings that into clearer focus.
So let's talk about some of the studies. There are two in particular that you've written about that you've referenced. And we'll work through the details as we go. But give us a sort of a broad sense and the significance of these studies.
Okay. Well, last summer I was spending some time at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and was in the audience when a number of presentations about climate trends were being made by the scientists there. One of the presentations was from Cinta Peacock, who's an NCARS researcher, and she looked at a really broad array of global trends that all point to our climate today appears to be on a track that's dissimilar from past tracks in significant ways, and tie that to carbon dioxide,
right,
and other greenhouse gases. And then also talked about future trends and the trajectory that was going in. In her presentation of all these worldwide phenomenon, I was blown away by a simulation that they had of what appeared to be snowpack in the Rockies. And I contacted her recently to talk to her when I learned about Rob Gillies' paper and the trends that he had found on a much more fine scale.
Yeah.
So
hers was big.
Hers was enormous.
And Rob's, as we'll talk about, is pretty focused.
Right. And the interesting thing that's happening is that science to me is like a river. It's a flow. Yeah. And information is constantly changing and you're learning more all the time. It's not like a box, something fixed that you can measure over and over and over and take out the contents and analyze the contents. It's a process. And so in this process of understanding climate, which is extremely complex,
yeah,
and it's not only about Utah or only about salinity in oceans or temperatures. It's about a lot of things. What's really interesting to me is that we're getting better and better at zeroing in on immediate information. What Rob did was he took local measurements from a wide variety of perspectives and came up with the same kind of conclusions that Cinta did. The two are that more precipitation is coming as rain rather than snow.
Right.
And number two, that the fluctuations, you know, are going to be more and more intense or appear to be getting more and more intense.
Fluctuations of storms.
Of storms,
right,
exactly, and precipitation events. So I hope I summarized that adequately. But again, it's really amazing because before we had to look at the broad brush trends, but as we get better computing power and more people really looking at this, critiquing the old studies, looking for the holes, trying to find out how to answer the problems that are still out there, we're getting more and more conclusive information about what really is happening. Not still, I think, and I think Rob and Randy can talk to this, but we can't make actual predictions and say we're only going to have, you know, 2 inches of rainfall in March in 2050,
yeah,
but which I think everyone would like. But they can say the trend appears to be going this way, and these are the ways we seem to know that.
And what's important about that is scientists haven't been able to necessarily say that. They're now being able to identify a very discrete trend.
Right, right. And ultimately, I ski, and I love the snow in the mountains here, but I don't know that that's really the big problem here. That might mean a couple of fewer weekends of pleasure out in the mountains. But I think the big thing for Utah, and again, Randy can talk to this.
I should mention
really well.
This Randy you're talking about. Okay. We haven't introduced
Randy
yet, but I will.
That's
Randy,
right.
Julander, yeah, who is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor. We'll get him involved
in the
conversation in a moment. Go ahead.
The big issue to me is water and water supply and making sure that there's enough water for people to drink and to live comfortable lives. That's really the one of the key elements of our lifestyle, and if the patterns change too much, we might not have enough time to really adapt to capturing the water and essentially protecting a resource that's essential to our way of life.
Rob Gillis, let me ask you. So in her piece, Judy talks about this as being the most – your study with Utah State mm-hmm. – the most detailed and comprehensive scientific look at snow and rain patterns that's ever been done in the state. So this is a pretty expansive survey that you had to do, I suppose.
Oh, very much so, Doug. And actually, I have Randy to thank for it because I saw his presentation in 2010, Randy, down at the Utah Water Users Conference. You were a keynote, I think. Was it 2010?
Probably so, yes.
Randy brought up these results, which actually shocked me because they were diametrically opposite to what I had read in the literature. So I thought, well, okay.
Wait, explain that. What do you mean? So he was saying
he was saying there's no climate change signal in the snow course data.
Right.
That is very noisy. There are many studies in the Journal of Climate that have used snow course data and have shown warming in the Intermountain West. So that really puzzled me. I thought, geez, you know, what's going on here? So I thought, well, let's stay away from snow course data.
What is snow course data? Do you want to explain that?
I think Randy should explain that.
Okay, Randy, let me introduce you because we're sort of talking behind your back before introducing. Randy Julander is with us, as I said, snow survey supervisor for the United States Natural Resource Conservation Service. We're going to get to you in a moment, Randy, but explain what snow course – what is it? Snow course data.
Data.
Yeah, sorry.
What that is our specific charge from Congress is to measure snowpack and produce water supply forecasts for the mountainous areas of the western United States. Obviously, water is a key component of everything we do right here. And so we have been monitoring snowpacks at the higher elevations of Utah and all the western states now since the basically in the mid-1920s.
Okay.
So we have a long-term database.
Great. Okay, good. All right.
So that data is available, and there's also data from snowtell sites as well, which has been highly published. So we didn't want to go that route. So we thought one way to get, you know, confidence in your science is to look at a particular problem from many angles. And so we decided to do that using various data sets, in fact, multiple data sets, starting off with the Historical Climate Network, which is quality-controlled observations that has about a 100-year record, although we didn't analyze 100 years, and I can explain why we didn't do that in a minute.
But you used historical records.
We used historical records. Then we also used the historical records are mostly at low to mid elevations. They're not at high elevations. So in order to cover that, we used gridded data that was available. In fact, we used five gridded data sets from various locations, all of which had been published in the literature. One came from the Climate Prediction Center. That's a NOAA entity. So we used all those data sets, those gridded data sets. But then we used a technique called a rain-snow threshold technique to break out how much was rain versus snow. And I don't think we should get into the details of that because it's a little bit. And then we thought, well, okay, we can access satellite data and look at aerial extent of snow as well as other aspects. Then we went even further and did something that has never been done before. We actually cataloged all the storms from the early 50s to present that bring in our weather. And these are we call troughs. Mm-hmm. So we looked at the number of troughs and how the troughs were coming in. And we also looked at the other aspect of what brings in our precipitation, and that is subtropical jet type. So this, like the Pineapple Express, probably you've heard that term.
Yeah.
We looked at that. And then we applied, once we got, this was all observational data, then we used reanalysis data, which is a fairly complex data set that's worldwide, that's provided by NOAA and NASA, to actually look at what has changed that reflects, you know, the observational change.
Yeah.
So a huge amount of gridded data, a huge amount of observational data, and a huge amount of climate diagnostic data.
So let me ask you about warming first. It's interesting, as I read it, and I I'm not very good at the reading it, but Judy makes it clear, to me anyway, that studies show the average global temperature has increased, as she puts in her article, 0.27 Fahrenheit each decade. It's getting hotter in that sense. In Utah, it's double that?
Yes. I mean, and this is where a lot of people get confused as to what is a global temperature signal versus a regional temperature signal. And they're both quite different. It's kind of like, in a sense, an analogy might be that you heat up your house, so you use a certain amount of energy and you lose a certain amount of energy, but you redistribute that energy throughout different rooms. You might want to keep your bedroom cooler and your living room warmer.
Yeah.
So that's really where that comes about.
So Utah's is getting warmer. It's faster than the rest of the world in an average sense. Right?
And the West is.
In the West.
And the West, most definitely. And our climate diagnostic data, as you probably saw, one of the last figures was using the reanalysis data to show that the troposphere is indeed warming here in Utah. So the troposphere is that area that we live in. It's from, say, sea level up to about 12 kilometers or something like that.
Could I, and Judy, get in on this too, and Randy, for that matter, you as well. So let's say, again, people have these hunches when they were kids, right, playing in snowbanks and stuff like that, and they're not seeing as much of that. So would I be able to notice, you know, that it's warmer on an average basis, of course, now than it was in the past? Like, would the average person be able to detect that, notice that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and I would say, of course, you can notice it. It's your experience. It's your understanding of the world, but it would be an imperfect understanding unless you were 80 or 90 years old, or maybe even over 30.
Yeah. You've got to have more experience, right? But people are. Does that make sense, Rob Gyos?
Well, you know, in a sense, it makes sense.
It's warming. Are we noticing it's warming?
Well, certainly, I've been here in Utah for 15 years. When I first came here, it was extremely cold, and I've noticed it. But a lot of people, I don't think, do necessarily notice it. They might, maybe they have a hunch, but they often get mixed up between weather and climate too.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm often faced with the argument, well, it was extremely wet last year and it's extremely dry this year.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't look at it that way.
You can't
look at it that way. It is within the realm of natural variability that those extremes will occur.
Right.
If you want to look at a trend over time, then you really have to burrow down into multiple lines of evidence, scientific evidence.
Yeah. Randy, what do you make of that question?
In that particular sense, everybody's memory is always faulty.
Right.
It always is. And you never trust anything unless you've got data sitting in front of you. The business that I remember this and it seemed to be that is all fine and good for sitting on the front porch, but not much else.
Yeah. Let me ask you about what I think is an interesting trend, this idea that we're having more, what seems to be more rain than snow.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated, of course. One, and I'm not sure if this was your finding, Rob, or the other one, but suggests that there's going to be more rain than snow, according to this to your study, 9% increase. Is that right?
A 9% decrease in snow.
Decrease in snow. Forgive me.
That
yes,
we've
yes.
seen. There's more precipitation coming into the state, and more is coming in as rain at the expense of snow. And that's the observation. Now, the interesting thing is when you look at the trough type, the frequency of these systems that bring in our precipitation, they are decreasing. And that seems strange, doesn't it? Because if they're decreasing...
Then the number of storms.
Yeah. Why are we getting more precipitation?
Yeah.
Well, that was an interesting point that one of the reviewers brought up of the paper. And we went and then did some more extensive analysis and showed that the intensity of the precipitation was increasing. So even though you're getting less storms, they're more intense.
Yeah.
And I just would like to point out, Rob probably can talk to this even more clearly than I could, that it's a little bit counterintuitive. We think that we associate snow with cold, but really the fact that we might have bigger storms and more snow is a reflection of there's more moisture in the atmosphere, which again is consistent in all the climate models. And number two, that it's warmer because you get snow formation when the air temperature is warmer.
Right.
And let me follow on with that. With the climate diagnostic techniques, looking at the reanalysis data, we can see the convergence of moisture flux and the heating of the atmosphere, and another thing we call the vertical velocity has increased. So all those dynamic processes are causing this intense precipitation regime.
Rob, you've said the hydroclimate has changed.
So yes, the hydroclimate has changed because you're getting more rain and less snow. Now, if you, Randy can probably talk to this more, if you divide the snow water equivalent by the runoff, the snow water equivalent is when you melt the snow and calculate how much liquid is there. That's actually an index of how important snow is to your state, and it's extremely high for Utah. So Utah is now getting less snow but more rain. So the whole hydroclimate, that way that water is distributed over the landscape has changed. And presumably then water managers who are used to our particular regime will have to think, well, this is changing, and how should we change the way that we tap or capture those water resources?
It just means it'll be harder to capture water.
I think so.
Yeah.
But I'm not a water manager.
Sure.
Randy is, and he would certainly be able to answer that question.
But what does that mean that the hydroclimate has changed in the sense of will the landscape look different? Will it be less green, more verdant, less verdant?
That's a tough question.
Really?
When you change the hydroclimate, you change the ecology of your landscape.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So you may have less snow at certain elevations, which would normally percolate into the soil at a given rate, but now you're having that water just hit the ground and run off.
Yeah.
And so potentially, yes. You know, an ecologist will say there will be a big difference in landscape.
And one other thing, when the Salt Lake Tribune did a series on climate change back in 2006, we explored the way that the group of people we call the Anasazi typically fled the Four Corners area during two different periods in history. And that, I was told at the time, was associated not with the fact that the climate changed, because they live with climate change all the time,
sure,
like everybody does. But on a broader scale, the climate changed so rapidly during those two periods, they couldn't adapt their crops and their tools and their land to provide enough food for everyone. So they went to Texas.
I want to get Randy Julander's perspective on all of this when we get back from a break. Let me invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Judy Fay's with us, a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. A link to her recent article about climate change and Utah snowpack is on our website. Her website also, ours is kuer.org/radiowest. Rob Gillis with us, the director of the Utah Climate Center at Utah State University, and Randy Julander, Utah Snow Survey Supervisor for the United States National Resources Conservation Service. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of snow in Utah, the results of a warming climate as part of the discussion. Snow in this state usually covers the mountains well into summer, but some recent studies are showing that spring snowpack throughout the Mountain West is dwindling. We're talking about the consequences of all of this. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have Judy Fays with us, a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, where she covers environmental issues and pollution. She has a recent article, in fact, that got us thinking about all of this last Sunday. She published a piece about climate change and Utah snowpack. Rob Gillis is with us. He's the director of the Utah Climate Center at Utah State University. We also have with us Randy Julander, the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor for the U.S. National Resources Conservation Service. And Randy Julander, I want to turn to you. Talk about something, say something if you would, about the system that we have to collect this data, because you've written that this collection system was designed to forecast the water situation, but not exactly for making conclusions about climate change.
That is correct. Our snow survey data, which has been collected now for 80, 90 years, was originally designed, operated, and maintained to forecast water supply. So it's a relational system. It's never been advertised as this is the truth about snowpack. We measure it at this particular point. And as time goes on, those points change. And so you have to, just like all other data collection systems, it has both random and systematic bias in it. In this particular case, I would like to make at least one comment on the rain on snow, more rain, less snow kind of a thing.
Yeah.
In the short run, that could be a positive thing. In the long run, of course, that's going to be worse for Utah as snowpack shrink and shrink. But
how's that a good thing in the even in the short term?
In the short term? Well, it's all a question of mathematics. If you are melting snow at 2 inches per day and you're losing 1 inch of that snow melt to soil infiltration, you're getting 1 inch of runoff. But if you add a 1 inch rainstorm on that, how much are you getting? That's 2 inches. Mm. 2 inches beats 1 inch every day. And so for that short period of time, you're getting more water. And the other thing that's interesting to note is that rain does not melt snow. Rain is a very poor conductor of energy into your snowpack. For that matter, temperature is a very poor energy source for snow. Roughly 60 to 70% of your energy balance from snow comes from shortwave solar radiation, which isn't going to change under any climate-driven scenario. And so in the long term, rain on snow is bad, but in the short term, it doesn't melt snow. Give you an example. It would take 80 inches of rain to melt 1 inch of snow water equivalent at 1 degree C. You can see that if you have a flood in that particular situation, it came from the rain. It didn't come from the snow kind of a situation. But our data collection system actually measures snow on the ground where it counts in those water-producing areas of the state, and we have a long-term record. That's not to say that it's a perfect record.
Yeah.
It has its problems. And that's one of the things we've tried to bring out.
But one of the things you're saying, it's hard to say, you're somewhat skeptical of these studies?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Emphatically, yes. And there are a couple of good reasons why. Most of the studies that have been shown to show these dramatic declines in snowpack have started in 1950 and ended in the 2000. 1950s in the state of Utah, and may I just say, I operate in Utah. I don't go outside of my sandbox. I'm not talking about any other state. This is where I'm an expert.
Right.
The 1950s were the highest snowpack decade on record. And the 2000s were very similar to the 1930s. So when you try to establish a trend line and you start at a peak and end in a valley, what you're doing is you're making the maximum trend line possible. If you take these studies and then you go back to the 1930s and compare then the drought that we've just been through in the 1990s and the 2000s is very comparable. And that's one of the points that we'd like to bring out in this situation right here is where you start and where you end a trend analysis is very, very important. It's not to say that mine's right and everybody else is wrong, but we try to use all the data that we have available. The second thing we have is creeping into our data collection system is the systematic bias by site change. And we've taken the 15 longest-term snow courses that we have. Approximately 50% of them have had significant site changes. We document those. We have photos from the 1930s. We have photos that are current. We can see the vegetation change. And then we go and actually measure that snow course. We measure it the way it should be, and then we measure it perpendicular to that to see the influence that vegetation has had on that. Vegetation studies on snowpack have been done for many, many years, and there's literally dozens of them and documented. The bottom line is if you go from an open meadow to a conifer situation, you'll lose 40% of your snowpack. And that's what we see at approximately half of our sites. If you don't take those systematic biases into account, then what you're doing is overinflating the actual decline in snowpack that you see.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is that – now, you're not a skeptic of global climate change, are you?
Absolutely not. In fact, the USDA policy of my agency right here states that climate is changing, that it's primarily driven by CO2, and that it's relatively well understood.
But what you're just saying is that it may not be having the impact on snowpack that other people are suggesting.
Like I say, when you start and when you end make a big difference. Yeah. For example, right now, the average decadal deviation from the long-term period of record mean for the good sites that we have here in Utah?
Yeah, that didn't mean anything to me.
Excellent.
Okay.
the bottom line is the last 10 years, when compared to all of the other years in our record right here, our good sites are only, on average, 5% less snowpack than the period of record mean. That's not a huge change. The worst sites that we have, the ones that we have known documented problems, are only running 13% below that long-term average. And so that's a problem with using trend analyses in these things. If you don't update that every year, you don't never know whether you're increasing, decreasing, or anything like that. And in the past few years have been relatively kind.
Yeah.
In terms of snow accumulation.
Rob Gillis, I want to get you to sort of respond to, I guess, these disclaimers that Randy Julander throws into the mix. And I need to say something, and delicately put it, Randy Julander. So your study has not been peer-reviewed.
No.
Is that right?
That is correct.
Now, Rob's, yours has.
Yes.
It's not delicate. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that's important to point out. And I'm not questioning Randy Julander, your studies by any means, but I think that needs to be made. We need to make note of that. That noted. Do you want to say anything about that, Randy Julander?
Oh, absolutely. In terms of the peer-reviewed study, that is a process that goes through. I'm not an academic. I don't play in that particular sandbox. I don't have any need to go that direction. But what I am is an expert on my own data. And when I see the peer-reviewed studies come through that have not checked off everybody's data collection system has systematic bias. I mean, the temperature record undergoes half a dozen checks and corrections, additions, deletions, and things like that. It's inconceivable that someone could analyze a data set without checking first for that systematic bias. And all of these peer-reviewed studies have not. How do I know? I have the metadata that supports it, and nobody's come asking for it.
Rob Gillis, to this question that the trend you've looked at wasn't long enough.
Well, let me back off a little bit here. I mean, Randy's claiming that these scientists don't account for example, Phil Mote in his paper discussed that changes in land use cover at snow courses would introduce a non-climatic trend. So I disagree with them that these scientists don't actually take that into account. If you actually look at all these papers, again, Phil wrote another paper.
No, you need to tell us who Phil is.
Phil Mote is the director of the Climate Center in Oregon. Okay. And he's, also, I believe, he's actually on the IPCC panel this year, or this time around. But he also stated...
I'm sorry, what is the IPCC?
I thought you would know that one.
International Panel on Climate Change.
Okay, yeah. But not everyone does. So keep going, sorry.
Well, Phil noted, because I went and looked last night, he said, anecdotal evidence from snow surveyors suggests that possible cause one, that is changes in land cover, is a factor at some locations, though not generally the dominant factor. Okay, no systematic documentation of changes in site characteristics has been compiled. Okay, so, you know, the bottom line is these scientists are taking, you know, care of, you know, the biases that are in the data. Randy also mentioned the temperature data. The National Center that keeps the climate data publish all this data. They account for the biases all the time, and it's published. So it's not fair to say that this is not accounted for in the data set. The second thing I looked up in my paper is, you know, Randy was talking about, you know, the snow melt and rain falling on the snow and how much would, you know, that would change the sort of hydroclimate. And if I can just read from my paper here, about that, it says another factor resides in the fact that rain is usually accompanied by high humidity, just means very moist.
Yeah.
Okay. Resulting in vapor pressures in excess of the saturation vapor pressure over ice. Now, that may be a little bit hard. This is an environment ripe for condensation, especially if it's windy. The latent heat released by condensation at 0 degrees is 25,000. It takes 334 to melt ice. So for every 1 centimeter of water condensation, there is 7 centimeters of melt. And that's physics, thermodynamics.
Okay, so basically, and Judy, this is why it's so hard, isn't it, to cover this stuff? I mean, there's a professional disagreement, I take it from you, about the impacts of all of this. I mean, you all agree that there is global climate change. The question that Randy raises is the effect that it might have on snowpack. Right.
But then, you know, to come to the trends, you know, Randy's right in what he says. But if you've got data from the 50s onward, you can do a trend analysis, and a fairly robust trend analysis, and have statistical confidence in what you do. And, of course, that's what's in our papers. We have, you know, the 95 or 99% confidence levels built into the analysis, which means we're confident about what the trend is telling us.
So, Judy, do you want to say anything about the sort of give and take that you hear about all of this? Is this typical?
It is, and it's wonderful. I think one of the questions that I would have, had I known about Randy's paper before I did my story on over the weekend, is it possible in some way that the data that Randy's collected and the data that Rob's crunched are compatible in a way that we just don't really understand right now? How do those two findings overlap? Maybe they don't. I don't know.
Well, I could answer that.
Okay.
My view would be you would not use snow course data for climate change analysis.
What about that, Randy?
In the case of the sites that have been compromised, I would fully agree, and we have a posted list of those on our website for anyone who would like to come in and use those. For sites that have not been compromised, I think they would be an ideal indicator of climate change. And we do have a complete list of all of the sites and all of the metadata available for anyone that wants one. And Phil Mote and I actually talked about this prior to him publishing his paper, and that's where that particular quote came from. At that point, we had not put together the metadata. Since then, we have, and it's available for those who would like to use it.
Let me ask about – Judy, go ahead.
I just wanted to say one other thing. I think the points that both Randy and Rob touch on, though, that are really important are that these issues are really interconnected, and that what's the changes in the land affect the climate, and the climate affects the changes in the land, vice versa. The Tribune reporter Brandon Loomis did a great package over the fall on how climate change is affecting the forests.
Yeah.
And that's something that we can really see out there. It's something that's very real, measurable. But again, all of the things these guys are both talking about interrelate with those other kinds of factors.
That's exactly correct. And this whole forest change, I'm rooting for the pine beetle because as a hydrologist, I look at every tree on that watershed as a water pump, pumping water out to the atmosphere. And that's one of the things that impacts stream flow. And that particular data set that has as much systematic bias in it as any other data set.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about just some basic kind of consequences. And I wonder if there's any agreement here. What does all of this mean for the impact of the water supply? Just very basically, Randy Julander, you're less concerned about water supply in the future than Rob Gillis might be. Is that fair?
Let's put it in context in terms of dates. I don't think over the next 20 to 30 years that we're going to see a whole lot different than what we are seeing now. Beyond that, when temperature really starts coming into play, I'll give you a classic example. When you start talking about temperature and the impacts of snow accumulation and melt, it would take 10 degrees C at Steel Creek Park on the north slope of the Uintas to bring the average temperature from minus 15 during the months of November through April. I just don't see snow disappearing in that kind of a context. And so as time marches on and we get a better handle on what the temperature trends are going to do and those kinds of things, and particularly not necessarily the temperature but the precipitation trends, will probably have as big an impact on our future water supplies as temperature is going to.
And Rob, you're more worried about the impact on snow.
I'm not
sorry. On snowpack, you're more worried.
Well, I'm not in a sense worried. I mean, as director of the Climate Center, I'm responsible for providing timely information for policy issues and things and many other things. So, as an individual, you know, this change in the precipitation regimes has certain consequences. I think Randy's underestimating the temperature effect, because that will really drive evapotranspiration up, and that will alter not just vegetation, but it will have consequences for agriculture.
Let me read a few emails. Maggie raises an important question. I can't help but wonder, she writes, what the research suggests then about human impact. What impressions do they get from the data of human contributions in the midst of changes due to these different cycles? And I guess the question is this human cost? That's the crucial question about global climate change anyway. Rob Gillis, can you make any conclusions?
So that's the attribution, and that is extremely difficult to do with this particular data set from the 1950s onwards, and I would not do that. In terms of the global climate change, there's lots of information out there as to the role of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in altering the global climate and therefore all the weather systems that are associated with it. So there is a human impact.
Yeah. Randy?
That is completely outside of my realm of expertise.
Okay.
No comment.
Here's an email from Ellen who writes, I remember going to a lecture at USU back in the mid-80s where a climate model for northern Utah was presented, and it projected slightly warmer, drier winters and slightly cooler, slightly wetter summers. It forecast the loss of our aspen and conifer forests switching to scrub and grasslands. She doesn't really raise a question there, but whoever this lecturer was back in the mid-80s, did they get it right?
Let me talk a little bit about that conversion of conifer from aspen to conifer, because that's a huge issue. The Colorado Basin has lost about 1.5 million acres of aspen to conifer. And according to LaMalfa and Rael, the difference between the potential water yield from those areas is about 10 inches. 10 inches out of 30 annual is a huge deal. And when you lose that kind of acreage from your aspen to conifer inclusion, it is going to have a profound effect on watershed response and your hydrology.
Okay, that's Randy Julander, who is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor with the United States Natural Resources Conservation Service. And Rob Gillis, Director of the Utah Climate Center at Utah State University. Judy Faze, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're late for the break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of snow in Utah, the results of a warming climate. We're exploring the consequences of climate change on Utah. We're talking about Judy Faye's article, basically, which she wrote over the weekend. She's with us here at the Salt Lake Tribune. Rob Gillis, Utah's state climatologist, director of the Utah Climate Center, and Randy Julander. He's the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor for the United States Natural Resources Conservation Council, a service, that is. So, Judy, we've got a shift, I guess, to what's sort of the next natural part of this conversation. And so if something's happening, which everyone seems to agree, there are some quibbles about, well, not just quibbles, but there's some particular differences about some details. But you've got to shift to what you do next, I guess.
In the public arena, I think that the question of is it or isn't it is kind of become passé, because that's really the realm of the scientist to duke it out and to figure out what the trend is. But more and more you see government organizations and environmental organizations looking at, well, what does it mean? How do we adapt to the changes that are out there? And that's happening in Utah, but apparently not to the extent that some people think it ought to be.
Which leads us to Steve Fleischley, who is the director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Water and Climate Program. He's joining us today from his office in Washington, D.C. Steve Fleischley, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to – so we're talking now about this question about what you do about it and who's doing what about it throughout the country. I wanted to ask you about what – you've been exploring this question, what states are doing what. One of the findings suggests that that some states are doing things, some states are not. We'll talk about particulars first, but what are the states that are – say something about that first of all. There are some that are reacting and there are some that aren't, I guess is what you're finding.
Yeah, so we – over the last year, we undertook a survey of all 50 states and what they're doing on climate preparedness, particularly around water resource issues. And we found that there are 9 states in the U.S. that have taken a comprehensive planning approach to address climate change and its impact on water resources. And then we found that 12 states really aren't doing much at all, and there are 29 states that are unprepared to address and have not planned sufficiently to address the water-related impacts from climate change that they could see in the near term and
right.
in out to 2050.
So you've got – it's interesting. You've put them in these categories, and the ones that seem to be more prepared than others, you put in Category 1, for example. You've got Alaska here, California, Massachusetts is in here, New York. What is it that they're doing? What do they have in common? What's the sort of public policy sensibility that makes them more ready than some others?
Well, there's a couple of different pieces. I think, you know, in terms of what they're doing, they're taking a comprehensive look at climate change and its potential impacts. They're looking at all water-related sectors from, you know, in some of these states, sea level rise to increased flooding to water supply challenges to aquatic species impact. And they're integrating those programs and saying, look, here's our state plan to address these issues. And then they have strong leadership in most of these instances at the executive level, at the governor level, to say, hey, we need to move forward to address these challenges and make sure that we, one, understand the vulnerabilities, which is really important, and what I think, you know, you all have been talking about this morning. And then,
yeah.
Two, what are we going to do about it?
Right.
How are we going to prepare ourselves for these changes?
But there's, it seems like – so you, this that if this has got to come from the top. There's you talk about the fact it's important that you have – a leader that has some vision, that provides some direction for all of this. I wanted to ask you, in Utah, for example, 2010, the Utah House of Representatives passed this resolution, which officially disputed the science of climate change, claimed that CO2 emissions are essentially harmless. And at the time, Utah's governor, Governor Herbert, said that he doubted global warming represented what he called an impending doom. And he said the debate about global warming was fraught with emotion, and the debate about whether and how the planet is warming would just rage on. Seemed a little skeptical, said there was something going on, but certainly didn't provide the kind of vision that maybe you're looking for. Does that stand in contrast to what you're hearing from other executives in other states?
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, I think you've heard today that there's a lot of science behind this conversation.
Yeah.
This is not an emotional conversation in many levels. It tends to be a political conversation, unfortunately, within some, you know, some circles. But where we see leadership, and we talked to state officials in all 50 states, and folks told us, look, if my governor were stronger on this issue, or my state legislature were stronger on this issue, or if I had a clear directive or some resources to address this challenge, we could do more. And where those resources are not available and that directive is not available, you know, the staff level folks tend not to focus their attention on these issues.
So Utah is, and you've got Alaska, California, as I mentioned, there's others in Category 1, and then you have Category 2 and Category 3. The last category, Category 4, Utah's here, along with Texas and Alabama, and strangely, a lot of Midwestern states, Arkansas, Kansas, Iowa.
Yeah.
What's that about? What do they have in common? Is there
well,
something?
Yeah, most of these states, actually all of these states, do not have an adaptation plan focused on water-related impacts from climate change. Utah, to its credit, and we do give it some credit in our report, Utah has done a decent job on water conservation. They do take that into consideration. They do think about that in long-term drought planning, but they don't explicitly address and plan around climate change and its potential impacts. And there are other states in our Category 4, for example, Ohio, Alabama, South Dakota that really haven't done anything and aren't doing anything on the emissions, the carbon pollution side either. Mm. So while Utah's in our worst category, I wouldn't say that Utah is the worst state.
No, but one of the things you say, as you said, that in the analysis that Utah's one of those states where some water programs and policies that, and you put it this way in the piece, if they were recognized as climate change adaptation tools, they could prove to be beneficial.
Yeah. And you know, there are a number of things you can do, for example, with water conservation. But the key is, are you planning those measures around the water needs that you will face in the future? Or are you doing it to address population, for example, or other, you know, extractive uses or other sorts of things? And so our point is, look, if you want to get credit for climate preparedness and planning, you need to think about it in that context. You can't simply say, well, we're planning to the year 2030 because we know there's going to be increased population and leave the conversation there. You have to take into consideration these concerns about water supply availability issues and focus on those as targets and address them.
Judy Fase, is that an obstacle the state is sort of confronting, that they're going to have to, there's going to have to be some sort of political acknowledgement at least? And more of a sort of vibrant conversation about global climate change for there to be some sort of adaptation plan?
I think if I was a politician, I'd be better prepared to answer that.
Right.
But what I can say is that I think he brings up a really great point. Even if Utah goes down this road of trying to develop more of its energy resources, oil, shale, nuclear power, all of those things require massive amounts of water. So whether or not there's enough water there is going to be a crucial issue, whether we're talking about having a lot of swimming pools and green lawns or whether we want to have a lot of electricity for all of our various uses. It's a really big question. And currently the state, my recollection is that previously there were 3 to 5 people on the state staff who were addressing climate change issues. Currently, I don't know the name of one person who is monitoring climate change impacts and what that means for the state in the future.
It's Judy Fase, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find a link about her article on our website. Judy, thanks very much for being with us. Steve Fleishley, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Water and Climate Program, joined us from Washington. Mr. Fleishley, thanks very much to you.
Thank you, Doug.
And Rob Gillis and Randy Julander, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KEWR News, program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.